Hi, this is Tavi Greiner, Astronomy.fm's Vice President of Communications. If you enjoy our programming, please let us know with a donation to astronomy.fm/donate. We really do rely on your support, and it's true, every little bit counts.
AFM.
Program complete. Enter when ready.
The curtain of night is drawn back. The telescopes are trained. The domes are open. The audience is set. Now, step into the Event Horizon.
Well, good evening, everyone, and welcome to the Event Horizon here on Astronomy.fm Radio. That means it is another Friday night, and this one happens to be February the 17th, 2017, at 9:01 in the evening for those of us here in the eastern portion of North America. So that means Universal Time, it would be 2:01 on February the 18th, 2017, Saturday morning. So you're listening to us live. That means our chat room is a happening place. Yeah, so come on over to the chat room, astronomy.fm/chat. That'll get you to the login page. You can ask us questions. We will try to answer your questions right on air. But yeah, you can basically chat with us and other people live. So come on over to the chat room.
And don't forget, if you go to the website, the links will be there for the show after the show finishes. And by the way, my name is Tony Stark, by the way, because Marty didn't bother to introduce me tonight.
I just didn't get there yet. We are in the chat room. We got Twist Edge, Glenn, Black Project, Starstorm, Aquafuse so far. Come on over to our chat room here. Yeah, you don't have to use your real name, as long as it's something we can pronounce generally. So
yes,
glad to have you here.
Friendly folks, just remember, we don't know who is on a parent's account to join the AFM chat room and listen and enjoy, and take part in the show.
That's right. Let's see. Let's go through. Just do a little bit of the sun like I usually do. Sunspots, gone. Never mind. But solar activity is actually kind of up as far as solar wind goes. Just a couple days ago, I was reporting that it was low, but they were expected to get some solar winds increasing. And, yep, we have. It was speed was a little under 400 kilometers per second. Now it's over 400 kilometers per second, the solar wind. And the density's gone up to about double, too. So we're now up to about 9 protons per cubic centimeter. That means that there is a coronal hole on the sun right now. So particles are streaming out. Not a lot of activity coming from the sun, so you're going to have to pretty much be right around the Arctic Circle in order to be able to see some aurora happening. But definitely a good few days of auroral activity should be expected if you live at pretty high latitudes right now.
Well, let's go back in time, shall we, Marty?
Well, right, how far back should we go?
Yeah, we're going to go back 50 years. 50 years before the discovery of exoplanets.
I was going to say our limit would be 13.8 billion years.
That's the day. Yeah, we don't want to go back to event one.
Okay. Because
if we do that, we could get stuck and get cooked. We're actually going to go back 50 years before the first discovery of exoplanets. We're going back to basically around the UK of about the 50s or 60s.
Okay.
And a prime minister who shocked everybody for his actual knowledge and ability to deduct science. Obviously, I'm talking about Winston Spencer Churchill. And he was writing in a memoir about things we actually take for granted today. So I'll put the link into chat.
All right.
Okay. So Winston Churchill wrote about things he wrote about exoplanets before we had even thought about them and discovered them. He wrote about the possibility of the life on other planets. In fact, he even wrote about habitable zones and the Goldilocks zone in particular. And one of his statements, he actually writes, he surmises that there would be, at the proper distance from the parent sun, planets who would be the right size to keep their surface water and possibly an atmosphere of sorts. Now, and be able to sustain a suitable temperature. Now, think about this, people. This is a Victorian, someone brought up in the Victorian period, and at that point, even astronomy hadn't thought about the possibility of life, apart from science fiction, where they lived on the moon, Venus, and maybe Mars or Jupiter.
Yep.
But these were fictional. These were the bug-eyed monsters of that they wrote about. But here is a wartime prime minister considering many modern arguments that are current in astrobiology. He built on the Copernican principle, the idea that human life on Earth shouldn't be unique given the vastness of the universe. He defined life as the ability to breed and multiply, and noted that the vital importance of liquid water, explaining all living things of the type we know, require it. Now, this is a time when a country is coming out of war, and this is a country that has based its success on science, on radar. Radar was developed by people like Sir Bernard Lovell, who then turned his mind onto radio astronomy and built Jodrell Bank at a time most people really were not even thinking about it. He was using wartime equipment. He was using wire antennas in a field near Alderney Edge. And it really astounds me that something like this could actually happen. Someone could actually think ahead and even prophesy, perhaps that was the best word, what is yet to come and what is slowly coming around. Now, that I call a real stroke of genius. Now, at the moment, the essay is the title is Are We Alone in the Universe? At the moment, it is apparently under the control of the Churchill estate. There are talks going on to have the document made public and made available for people to read it. Whether it's going to be on the internet or as an ebook or what, I don't know yet. However, watch this space. Now, the person involved with this, Dr. Livio, is describing the discovery of the essay as a great surprise. And it is his mission at the moment, in a lot of cases, to actually get this out for the public to read. I can't wait. The story is in the latest issue of the Nature Journal. So if you can get a copy of it, or you can get someone who can scan it and copy it for you, read it. I think it's going to be a very interesting look back, and we're going to say, well, you know what? It was there all along.
I'm just thinking, amazing how far radar has actually come in using for astronomy. Every time I would hear things that was like just amazing, they would actually bounce radar waves off of Venus.
Yep.
And I can't remember if they were actually detecting surface features from the Earth about Venus. I know a lot of the stuff was actually determining distances. But actually starting to pick up shapes and sizes and things like that, picking up shapes and sizes of asteroids. So, yeah, radar was really well outshot, reasonably far out into the solar system to pick up things.
And look, the greatest thing is, as we've said often, Marty, it's trickle down. It's something mm-hmm. that was built or created for a military purpose, mm-hmm. and in the end, it has come around and become perhaps a great civilian application. And I think it really has come into its own, certainly in the astronomical community, particularly in the near-Earth object field, where we can actually image some of these near-Earth objects much easier with radar than we can optically, because they're so fast.
Mm-hmm. Well, I want to differentiate between radar and radio waves. Radar is something that is actually pulsed out from the Earth using a giant dish, and it actually sends a pulse signal out to an object, strikes the object, it bounces back to the Earth, and by timing how long it takes to go out and come back, that determines its distance. The bigger the radar dish, moving it slightly will determine the size of an object. So the more they can turn it, and the higher the resolution of the radio dish, the more they can determine the size of an object. And also, once you determine the size of the object, then you can get even a bigger dish. You can actually start measuring features on an object. Now, radio waves, basically, that is something different. That's actually picking up radio signals that is produced out in space and then picked up from dishes and antennas here on the Earth itself. So radio waves is picking up signals from space. Radar is projecting the signal out into space, have it bounce off something, and then bounce back to us.
Well, it's still a form of radio waves, Marty, because it's an electromagnetic pulse, so is a radio wave.
Yep, it's just done differently, though, between radio waves and radar astronomy.
Well, yeah, the radar is definitely a steered and transmitted signal, and we receive the echo back,
right,
and that gives us the information.
Yep.
But it's still using radio waves because mm-hmm. they're in the Hertzian spectrum.
Yep. Just two general different methods, though. Let's give a quick rundown of what's happening in the sky. Have you noticed Venus out there?
Yes, I have. I came home tonight. So there was Venus. There was a star and this lovely band of thin cloud separating them.
Yes, Venus is looking really nice right now. Of course, it is listed as on the U.S. Naval Observatory's webpage called Astronomical Almanac Online. It says Venus' greatest illuminated extent, which I think it means it's the brightest. It's been looking pretty good for quite a while. It'll last still for several weeks. Quite this bright. Now Saturday's last quarter moon, and also Saturday the moon will be at apogee, which means it'll be its farthest in its orbit on Saturday. Monday, Saturn will be 4 degrees south of the moon. Thursday, Jupiter will be 4 degrees north of Spica. So Jupiter and Spica kind of close together early in the evening. Yeah, you might not have noticed this when you're looking at Venus in the evening. If you look about 5 degrees towards the northeast, faint star there, that's actually the planet Mars. And with a little bit of help from a telescope, keep going, you'll also see the planet Uranus in there too. So there's actually kind of a mini conjunction between Venus, Mars, and Uranus in the sky.
On Saturday, last quarter moon is exact at 2:33 p.m. Before dawn on Sunday the 19th, look for it in the southwest. Antares and Upper Scorpius are below and to the lower right of it. Saturn is further to its lower left.
Saturn early in the morning. Yes, finally starting to come back around. Mars has actually been hanging around for quite a while, if you've noticed that too. It does, because its orbit is twice as long as the Earth. So we're both going around the sun, and Mars is taking twice as long. So it actually stays in our sky above the horizon for quite a while. So it's still out there, but if you try looking through it through a telescope, it's actually pretty far. It's kind of on the far side of the sun from us right now. So not so great to look at, but it's in the sky technically.
Yep.
More discoveries.
Well, the thing is, that great yellow orb you see during the daytime is another star. We just observe it differently.
Yep. And being this bright, this is a good time. I encourage everybody to try to look for Venus during the daytime. It is quite visible if you know where to look for it. So you're going to have to wait till maybe a little afternoon, because you got to figure out, you know, when Venus is on the horizon. Sorry, when the sun's on the horizon and you can start to see Venus, it's still pretty far away from it, you know, like 25, 30 degrees or more, something like that. So you got to expect the sun to be maybe a little bit past noontime and then look 30 degrees or so towards the east of the sun, and maybe be able to pick out Venus in the daytime. Being as bright as it is right now, this is a really good time to go for it.
Quickly, I just want to say hello to Glenn, Black Projects, Starstorm, Cassie, and Neptronics, who are in our chat room. Please, folks, come on in, enjoy yourself, have a good time, and share the links, and send us some links of your own.
Indeed. I mentioned last Wednesday, but coming up next, still viable, still next, when is it, the 26th, next Sunday for me, there's going to be a solar Solar eclipse or lunar eclipse? I've lost track.
The solar eclipse is not solar later in the year.
Yeah, but there's one down in South America. What is that? I think it's a solar eclipse.
Yeah.
And that's it. It's an annular solar eclipse down in the lower portions, southern portions, I should say, of South America. So I know we've got Optronics in our chat room right now. He's from Buenos Aires. So it's still going to be, I think, about, I calculated just roughly about 1,000 miles south of Buenos Aires. Still be a nice one to get to if you can. So if you're in South America and do a little bit of traveling, try to catch it. So that's just like coming up in about a week and a half or so.
Okay, another story I picked up on is Event Horizon Telescope ready to image a black hole.
Ah, perfect. Perfect.
I thought you'd like that one, Marty.
Yeah, I think so.
Right, what they're doing in actual fact is they have built an Earth-sized virtual telescope by linking a large array of radio receivers from the South Pole to Hawaii to the Americas and Europe. And scientists actually believe they're on the verge of obtaining the first ever picture of a black hole. There are optimism is that the observations are to be conducted between the 5th and 14th of April, and it could finally deliver the long sought after prize. Now, they're going after Sagittarius A. We've never seen it directly. We've seen hints of it, mostly in infrared and gamma. And, of course, we know about the famous dust curtain that is around it. So it does block out direct optical observation. Now, it's called the Event Horizon Telescope. And
it's actually a radio telescope.
It's actually a radio telescope, yes. And it's great because they're doing the one thing that is really fantastic, is they're linking everything together with an interferometer. So we actually have the world's largest telescope at the moment in existence to do this one job. Now, the project leader is Shepard Dolleman from Harvard Smithsonian Center for Astrophysics in Cambridge, Massachusetts. They've been fashioning the telescope for about 20 years now, and in April they're actually going to make the observations, and they really do think they have a real chance of bringing a black hole's event horizon into focus. So what telescopes are they using? Well, they're using the Northern Extended Millimeter Array in Europe, the IRAM 30 meter telescope. There's the Combined Array for Research in Millimeter Wave Astronomy, the Large Millimeter Telescope, the Caltech Submillimeter, the James Clerk Maxwell Telescope, the Submillimeter Array, the Arizona Radio Observatory and Submillimeter Wave Astronomy are involved, Atacama Pathfinder Experiment, Atacama Submillimeter Telescope Experiment, ALMA, and the South Pole Telescope are all going to be linked together in one very long baseline array via interferometry. Now, this is a trick we use in the UK. They use it with the Merlin, and it's actually used throughout the world. Groups of scientists will collaborate together. They'll link their telescopes via the internet in most cases, and they will pool the data. The fact this is probably the first time it's actually been done is going to be interesting. I can't wait. I want to see the image, the radio image they actually produce of an event horizon. It'll be a first even for us, Marty.
Mm-hmm. I'd have to look up what has been imaged down there already, because obviously we know there's a black hole there, and there's evidence of a black hole there. Some stars have been imaged going around. I know they have picked up visual or radio waves of things going into that black hole, as far as I remember. I'll have to look at and see what the difference is with this observation compared to what's before. Maybe it's just higher resolution.
Yes, they're aiming initially to get down to 50 micro arc seconds.
Okay.
So the analogy is describing the sharpness of vision of being the equivalent of seeing something the size of a grapefruit on the surface of the moon.
Mm-hmm. Then I know they have like quote unquote images. Well, let's not say they're going to image a black hole. They're not quite right. What they can do is detect stuff happening just outside the black hole. Basically, as particles orbit around a black hole really, really close to its last closest possible distance. The particles smash into each other, and they, you know, they just go on really fast. So they emit radio waves in very high frequencies, I forget, gamma rays, things like that. Where was I going with this? Okay, so basically you can only witness the stuff that's happening just outside the black hole. And the better resolution they're going to be using with these telescopes instead of seeing like a headlight in a fog, you'll actually be able to see, you know, what's written on the glass of a car, headlight, stuff like that. So basically defining the resolution.
Now, the other thing I'm seeing in the article is that they're describing the hard drives that are being used. They're having to install new, special equipment at all the observing sites that includes very big hard drives. Now, the description is the hard drive modules hold the capacity of about 100 standard laptops. They have multiple modules at each telescope. So they're talking about 10,000 laptops of data. It will then be put into the Haystacks Colorator computer. That's when the synthesis will begin. Now, some of the they've got some very smart imaging algorithms that have had to be developed to make sense of the observations, but it will not be a quick result.
Mm-hmm.
So, the biggest thing is, of course, with Atacama, it's extraordinary state of the art technology. At a stroke, has actually increased the EHT sensitivity by a factor of 10. This is why they're so optimistic ahead of April, because with everything that's gone into Atacama in the last few years, this is state-of-the-art technology. And this is stuff that has come literally straight off somebody's bench. It's been tested, and it's in the field, and it's in use.
Mm-hmm.
So we're lucky. We seem to be living in an age where the technology is getting there quicker, and it's getting into the field quicker, unlike the old days where it might have been having to wait until it became surplus equipment somewhere. I know a lot of guys who use surplus equipment for radio astronomy and for amateur radio, and the fact that you get suddenly get a state-of-the-art computer, you get a state-of-the-art receiver and everything to go with it, you are the top-of-the-heap facility. And this is what's really happened at Atacama.
Mm-hmm. I just read the article here. It says the black hole itself, which is basically the you know, let's call it the black part, does actually have a size to it, and it looks like it's about maybe about 20 million kilometers across. So let's guesstimate 15 million miles across. 15 million miles, that's about the distance from the center of the sun to Mercury, for instance. Now, trying to see something that size, which is not really that big, at 26,000 light years away. So that's the challenge of this thing. That's what they're trying to do, zoom in as close as they can and see the tightest amount of detail as close in as they could get to the thing.
And, of course, the whole point of this exercise is really to test for flaws in Einstein's ideas. Mm-hmm. But even getting a resolved image of SAG-A would be a triumph all of its own. However, the idea is to use the imaging capacity to go and test aspects of general relativity.
Mm-hmm.
They maybe expect to see some of the gas flowing around the black hole. That's really the next stage of what they're trying to accomplish with these imaging algorithms. First and foremost, the team needs really good weather at the participating observing stations in April. They're looking at a frequency of 1.3 millimeters. That is 230 gigahertz. This has the best chance of piercing any obscuring gas and dust in the vicinity of the black hole. But the big problem is there's too much water vapor above the array's receivers. Even the EHT will struggle even to see through the Earth's atmosphere.
Mm-hmm.
So one task is to get a resolved view of SAG-A. If they do that, it's a milestone. Of course, the real big bonus out of it is, can they resolve the flowing gases around a black hole? can they actually make a movie from this? It's not going to be a blockbuster on your silver screen. It's going to be a nice little computer image, but it will show us possibly what is going on around the event horizon. No, it won't look inside, unfortunately. Nothing escapes from a black hole. Nope. And it's going to take a lot longer for us to even perhaps never produce the equipment to look at it, look and see if there is indeed a naked singularity there. It'd be nice.
Yes. That'd be some different technology. Sagittarius A, well, you'll notice a little asterisk above the letter A. So it's usually called Sagittarius A star. And that does, again, refer to the black hole at the very center of the Milky Way galaxy. And, yes, lots of different tests have proved that it really is a black hole there. For one thing, they've actually watched stars circle around that spot and calculated the speed that they've gone around. That the only way a star could circle around a spot that small, that fast, is if there is a black hole there. And then just trying to guesstimate the size of the star that's going around it, how fast, how close it is, gives them the approximate mass of the black material that's in the black hole itself.
Then there's the nice little NASA page from the Chandra Space Telescope about Sag A star.
Sagittarius A star. There you go. let's see. What was I going to go with? Something related. Where was that?
Antimatter, neutrinos.
Something related to what we're kind of Sagittarius, maybe. Was it Sagittarius is going to talk about? I've lost it, so that means I'll come back to it.
Okay, well, I'll tell you what. Antimatter.
Antimatter?
You might not know about antimatter.
And Uncle...
Did you know that you give off antimatter, Marty?
Antimatter and Uncle Fred?
No, you give off antimatter.
What happens when you give off antimatter?
Well, what it is, the reason we give off antimatter is through potassium 40. It's something that you ingest when you eat bananas.
Okay.
Now, potassium 40 spits out a positron. And what is a positron? It's an antiparticle. So this is an offering from Symmetry magazine. Okay, so let me go to the top of the article. And okay, it's the stuff of science fiction. We all know it's in the film Angels and Demons and the book. It's the source of the Starship Enterprise's engine power. And of course, antimatter bombs and powered spacecraft have all been parts of science fiction since dot. So here's just a few fun things. Antimatter should have been annihilated all along with the matter in the universe after the Big Bang. Why wasn't it? Well, they think that when the matter and antimatter meet, they annihilate, leaving nothing but energy behind. So in principle, we shouldn't exist. But we do. As far as the physicists can tell, it's only because in the end, there was one extra matter particle for every billion matter-antimatter pairs. And we're still the physicists are still trying to figure out why there was this asymmetry. It's closer than you think.
Mm-hmm. So an antimatter is not that strange of stuff. So like people used to do sci-fi, you know, movies of antimatter beings living in an alternate universe. No, it's basically quote unquote normal matter with an opposite charge. Be a little bit more accurate. So it's not something that there's not an antimatter universe out there somewhere that's, you know, leaking into ours. Basically just regular matter with a different opposite charge. But when it contacts with regular matter, they both go zip and disappear.
Yep. Am I still there, Marty?
You're still here.
Oh, okay, because I thought I heard a boo as if Skype had dropped me. Okay, small amounts of antimatter constantly rain down on the Earth in the form of cosmic rays, energetic particles. These particles reach our atmosphere at the rate ranging from less than 1 per square meter to more than 100 per square meter. And we've seen evidence of antimatter production above rainstorms, red sprites. But as I say, the closest we're going to get to it is what our body admits when it contains potassium 40. So it's just a fun little fact there.
Oh, by the way.
Yeah?
I don't eat bananas.
You don't eat bananas?
No, I don't eat bananas.
Oh, wow, there's always one. Is there such thing as an antimatter trap, Marty?
Yeah, that's it. So I get sick on bananas once, and I've never been able to eat one since.
Okay, there is such a thing as an antimatter trap. Apparently, it's called it's called penning traps. It's an antimatter trap.
Okay.
They're comparable to little tiny accelerators inside particles. They spin around as the magnetic field and electric fields keep them from colliding with the walls of the trap. But penning traps won't work on neutral particles such as antihydrogen because they have no charge. Those particles cannot be confined by electric fields. Instead, they're held in Loffey traps, which work by creating a region of space where the magnetic field gets larger in all directions. Now, the Earth's magnetic field also acts as a sort of antimatter trap. Antiprotons have actually been found in zones around the Earth called the Van Allen radiation belts. And it can also fall up. So experiments such as Aegis Alpha and G-Bar are hard at work trying to find out what happens. Now, the standard model predicts that gravity should have the same effect on matter and antimatter. However, this has yet to be seen. So observing gravity's effect on antimatter is not quite as easy as watching an apple fall from a tree, they say. I just love this article. This is just brilliant. And have a look at it yourself. Enjoy it. And as I say, CERN actually has a machine called the Antiproton Deaccelerator. And it's a storage ring that can capture and slow antiprotons so their properties and behavior can be studied. Oh, you got to love it. You know, everybody used to whine about about CERN and the Large Hadron Collider. Oh, they're going to create a black hole. Well, even if they did, it would simply die in about 42 minutes because its event horizon is so small it can't feed. Hey, that's why 42 is still the meaning of life, the universe, and everything.
That's right. By the way, to the Event Horizon program here on astronomy.fm radio. We're halfway through our show, by the way, 9:32 in the evening for those of us here in the eastern portion of North America on Friday night, February the 17th, 2017. So that would make it in universal speak, 2:32, basically a.m. Saturday morning, February the 18th. So we're still live for another half hour, so we've still got an open invitation to come on over to our astronomy.fm chat room. Either go to the homepage or just type astronomy.fm with a / add the word chat. Either way, get you to the login page, type in a name, and hit login, and you will be here. We're reading the chat room as best as we can. I still have an issue with reading and talking about two different things. So. I can chew bubblegum and walk, though.
Yeah?
Uh-huh. Not too bad.
Oh, and the Black Project tells us the lethal dose of bananas is 400.
Ah.
I won't repeat this next part of his sentence. No one can ever reach a lethal radiation level. That's always good.
You can't keep it in. Let's just say that, yeah.
God. That's terrible.
I can't keep one banana in, so that's different. So.
Mm-hmm.
Makes me turn as green as a green banana.
you remember the fake pictures on APOD?
APOD? Oh, yes, indeed.
You remember the theft in other people's astronomical images?
Yes, I do.
Well, from what I've heard from one of my colleagues in the UK, somebody has stolen an images photograph, entered it in a competition in La Palma, and won with it.
Oh, no.
Oh, yeah. In fact, I was reading one of my friend's blogs from Nick Howes, and this is from one of the world's leading astro images, Adam Block, in a post commenting on copyright. Now, if this is actually 100% correct, it looks like a stolen image won a major competition. That, if that is true, that has just completely and utterly discredited that competition.
Depends if, or at least discredited, obviously, the person that published the photograph. It's hard to say how extensive they actually check the originality of the photographs themselves. Well, sometimes it's kind of tricky.
It worries me that if someone can take somebody else's work, publish it as their own, win a competition, which is supposed to be judged by the leading images.
Maybe, depending on who sponsors the competition, though. So I would tend to less blame the competition itself as opposed to the person that submitted the picture.
Well, as I say, what's happened was he won a competition worth 3,500 euros.
Okay.
And had the image published as his work on APOD. That was just one image. Now, I would not say I am the world's greatest imager. I'm not. And a lot of us, we're all good friends. We're friends with people like Damien and all the other guys out there who really rock our socks off with their images. Even with the ones taken under really extremely bad conditions, they still manage to pull a great image out. However, I think what it has to happen, this is just my personal view, I think that APOD shouldn't be run by people who image. It shouldn't just be anybody who volunteers and who probably has no real clue about the imaging itself.
So it should be run by imagers, is what you're saying.
Yes. What I'm saying, it should be run by imagers.
Yes.
And it should be particularly people who can go beyond the image. We all remember that the fake pictures with the ISS and everything.
Yes.
It really demeans the site. I'm sorry. I know NASA run the site as science outreach. And most of the people who are actually there scrutinizing do it on a volunteer basis of free time. But I think the site needs to be the judging and checking needs to be done now. You need to prove it by providing the original files. Mm-hmm. So they can not only can APOD see your basis for your work, but they can actually prove you actually did it.
Mm-hmm. I think so too. It's happening a little bit too much. One of our buddies, Stephen Ramsden from solarastronomy.org, the Solar Outreaches, was also complaining about people that copyright their astronomical images.
It's like, well, to be honest, I put my name on my image. When I post a picture, most of the time, I will put my name on it. I will also put the name of the telescope I used.
Mm-hmm.
Certain telescopes require you to, which is fine. A lot of them do need the advertising, that having their little logo in one corner or mentioning the fact that you took this picture on so-and-so's telescope in this location. And when you publish the pictures, you should really put the nitty-gritty. Tell us you should say what the telescope is, what the camera is, and all the technical details. Because I think the people who are doing the image theft might then cease and desist if they're being required now to give all the minor information. A lot of people do it. I know that some of the guys in the Comet Watch group on Comet Base and various groups across Facebook, etc., when they post an image, they are asked to post technical information.
Technical.
It saves a lot of work.
Technical's nice, but everybody thinks they have the world's greatest image, and beyond looking at it, nobody can touch their image, nobody can, put it on a publication, nobody can mention it without, considering paying them. There's so many astrophotographers out there that are willing to share their images for free. Don't ever buy an astronomy image from anybody, please. There's plenty of images out there that are free. In fact, every NASA image is free. Now, they would like credit, obviously, but every NASA image is free.
I think that's the important thing. If you're going to post somebody's image on your Facebook page, etc., credit the photographer, the imager.
At minimum credit it, yeah. It'd be nice if they didn't copyright it, just let it out there for the public to enjoy astronomy. It's instead of trying to keep it exclusive. It's, a bit ridiculous sometimes.
It's like my good friend Black Project. He posts when he does a lot of lunar imaging. He did a really cracking shot of the moon showing some of the pyroclastic flows on the lunar surface. Now, he puts them on his Flickr account so that we can see them, so he can and enjoy them. And I think this guy does some really great work. He's using a DSLR and a 127 Mac. I'm always enjoy looking at his pictures just because I know how much effort he's put into them.
I like what Stephen Ramsden did. He put the copyright image. He put the copyright information so big that you couldn't actually tell what the image was underneath it.
Well, I just put a little block of information. My name.
I know.
The telescope.
That's what most people do, but he just started to, like, took it for fun overboard.
Well, then again, we all do this for fun.
Yeah. It should be more fun.
You got any equipment plans for the future, Marty?
Equipment plans. My main equipment plan is to, again, rebuild my telescope, which I keep building and tearing apart because I don't like something about it. So that's the main thing with equipment lately, and learn more astrophotography stuff.
Yeah, I'm gonna get back into doing some dead serious imaging. I'm going to get back to FIT files. And in fact, one thing I want to do in the next few years is I'm going to invest in a second scope. Because I want to have one scope, my 10-inch Newtonian, I want to put to deep sky, so it's comets. Yeah. So I'll get an attic for that eventually, and that will be railed into the computer, and I'll be able to sit in a nice warm room and image to my heart's content. I also want something I can use for local stuff, for the moon and for the planets, that I can put my DSLR on. Again, I can wire it all into the computer, I can run it off software, and I can get the take off that, and then just enjoy myself processing the images. I think that is one of the things I enjoy about astroimaging, is playing with the images in stuff like Maxim DL, etc., and just having a bit of fun in the evening. Okay, nice image. It's nice JPEG. Brilliant. What can I do to bring out some more of the detail? I'll put it into a program, and I will load and then play with it and see what I can do. And I think, to be honest, it's not just producing the image I enjoy. I think it's actually spending the time and learning and expanding my horizons when it comes to the imaging software that's out there.
Yeah, that's my project too, imaging this year. Definitely going to get into, and image processing, of course, not just taking the pictures, but fixing the images after you take the picture.
And one of the things I will say, a lot of people say, but when I try to take pictures of this image stuff, the stars are wobbly. The best thing you can do is to put a windbreak up
that
around
helps,
your telescope, because that is going to be the biggest help. That is why most of us drool over the prospect of either a dome or a runoff roof shed, because the structure protects your telescope. It stops the wind hitting it. It stops wobble. And it stops a night's work basically going down the tubes, because you can't get anything to sit together. Yeah. So if you want to get serious about it, I would always say find a way to have, even if it's a semi-permanent arrangement to protect your telescope. And a beach windbreak probably would be a very good starting level way to do things. It's probably going to look very garish during the day, and you're going to get lots of people pointing at it and laughing. But who cares?
Nighttime. It's a nighttime.
They want to
see
it at night.
Yep. Some people have modified camping tents also to basically.
I've seen a couple of those.
Cut a hole in it. Observe through the hole in the camping tent too. Basically, it cuts down the wind and the wiggle and stuff like that too. Everything you can to improve your imaging is what really, really helps. And those people like Damien Peach that kick out these incredible photographs, they've got all of that figured out, and they do put a lot of work into it to getting the best pictures.
And
they
make
it look easy. It's like, oh, I guess I'm going to make another spectacular image of Jupiter again tomorrow, and they come up with one. It's like, that's like decades worth of work to get to that level that quickly.
It's not an overnight thing. It's take your image, play with it, learn from it, take another image, and then repeat the process. You're going to take about 3 or 4, maybe 10 years tops to get to Damien's level. Mm-hmm. And I'm going to – okay, sort of little plug. Damien has a DVD out on planetary imaging. You can get it through the Society for Popular Astronomy in the UK. It is sold both in the American video format and on the UK video format. If you really want a chance to learn from the master – get that DVD. It's probably going to cost about $20, roughly, I think.
More than worth it.
But it is going to be well worth it. He goes into everything. He talks about seeing. He talks about judging the conditions and how and why sometimes the coldest winter's night is not always the best condition
that
for
is correct.
Some things where it might be for other things.
Yes.
So get the DVD. It's about an hour and a half in length. But he breaks it up into chapters, and he really, really goes into how to do it. And he even, and I know in one of the chapters, he even goes through the process of using Registax. So I really, really do, hand on heart, recommend you get this for your video collection, because you are really going to get some really good use out of it.
Definitely. Sounds good to me. I'll check into it. Coming up, by the way, within a week or two, I'm going to be getting Jerry Hubble back again.
Sweet.
Wrote a book on making your own remote observatory. So I've got an update from him. So if not Wednesday, then maybe the Wednesday after that, I'll get him on radio once again. So stay tuned for
and
that.
And if you've got questions you want to ask this guy, write into us. Contact me and Marty, are both Marty and I, rather. We are both on Facebook. If you want to send stuff to me, I will pass it over to Marty. For questions during the show.
Yeah, my astronomy.fm email is not working, actually. So.
Mine works still.
Good.
So.
Oh, good.
But contact me, either Nick at astronomy.fm. Catch me on Facebook, on Twitter. If you've got a question you want to have asked during the show, let me know. I'll pass it on to Marty.
Mm-hmm. It's a couple things. InTheSky.org, I've been mentioning about Jupiter's moons orbiting. It shows up basically an orbiting chart. And I thought it was done a little bit backwards. And I spent at least a good week at asking different people. Yes, it was backwards. I contacted Dominic Ford, a professor at Cambridge, I think, that makes that website. He wrote back, said, yes, that there was an error in his chart. He thanked me for it. And he'll correct it. So appreciate that. And we'll mention more of Jupiter observations as the year goes on, because Jupiter's getting up a little earlier and earlier each night. So it's getting back into almost back into the evening sky, where it's more pleasant to observe. Now, this spring is going to be a nice time for observing Jupiter and its moons once again.
And of course, the other great thing is Jupiter is still an object that's heavily observed by amateurs, because there is still the chance you will catch an impact there. Ooh. Jupiter has this wonderful job. It is sometimes the Hoover of the solar system. Sometimes it's the slingshot of the solar system.
Yes,
as we well know.
By the way, NASA's Juno mission, orbiting around Jupiter, they've decided to continue with its present orbital configuration. So it's in a rather elongated orbit, where part of the orbit gets really close to Jupiter, within a couple thousand miles of its clouds, and then it swings out a ways, and then it swings back close again. They were going to tighten the orbit, but I think the idea is that they're having such success with the orbit that they have right now that they're going to stick with this type of orbit. They're not going to modify it to get in even closer. So they're going to stick with this. It's been successful, and it's going to keep on continuing. Lots of really interesting images from the Juno spacecraft orbiting around Jupiter. So check that out. And you can actually watch, when you're watching Jupiter, tell everybody, hey, there's a spacecraft circling around it right now, and you can show them what it looks like.
Yep. And it's one of those nice things is that they really like to release the images as soon as they can.
Yes.
None of this secrecy stuff, not until the paper's been written.
Mm-hmm.
but the interesting thing is the observations they're making are allowing them to slice literally the onion that Jupiter is as far as the clouds layers.
Mm-hmm.
So more and more we are learning about what Jupiter is, how it functions, and perhaps it will eventually tell us something about the early days of the solar system.
Yes, indeed. Got alert notice from the American Association of Variable Star Observers. You amateur astronomers out there can actually help protect the Hubble Space Telescope because they're going to point it at an eclipsing binary star. And what happens is the binary star, once in a while, it flares up, it gets bright. Well, they want to observe this star when it's dim, not when it's flaring up, because when it's flaring up, it can actually damage the Hubble Space Telescope. So for at least the next month or so, they want people to observe the star. It's actually too faint for your telescope to see, but that's a good thing. So if you can find the star field, look at it, and not see the star, all you have to do is report to them, I don't see the star. Now, you're going to tell them like the size of your telescope and stuff like that. I think it's like 14 to 15th magnitude. So I'll tell them you don't see it in an 8-inch. You don't see it in a 10-inch. You don't see it in a 20-inch. That, and if enough people tell them that, they'll say, okay, it's staying stable right up to the day before they're going to use a Hubble Space Telescope. It's safe to observe the star because nobody can see it. That means it's staying dim enough. So it's a great project for people because it's not something that's really hard to do because you're not trying to look at a 15th magnitude star. You're basically trying to not look at a 12th magnitude star. So check it out, American Association of Variable Star Observers. It's right in the homepage, alert notices. This one is alert notice 569. Help do real science and save the space telescope.
In fact, Marty, regards to our topic earlier about the pinched image, Black Projects actually put us a link into the chat room, which goes to the Cloudy Nights astronomical community, and it has a full thing about what's happened. So apparently APOD editors have now corrected the post.
Excellent. Very, very good. All right, we put an article in our chat room. This one looks pretty interesting. About a type of variable star. Now, the Milky Way galaxy has, hundred billion stars in it or so, something like that. But only about 400,000 of those are cataloged as variable stars. Well, this very unique type of variable star is one of seven known in the Milky Way galaxy.
The newest Delta Scuti.
Yes. So now when they call it a Delta Scuti, that's the original one that was found like this. So this is a different one, but not in the constellation of Scutum. So check this article out. It's in our chat room, and of course it'll be on our Facebook page. This is from SMU Research News.
We have a Facebook page, Marty?
We have astronomy.fm Facebook page.
Oh, yes, we have that one. Now, what do you think, folks? Do you think we need an Event Horizon page like the Space Pirates have? I'll throw that out there for discussion in the chat room.
Yeah, let's know. Now, there's actually a couple of astronomy.fm Facebook pages. I have one, which I started basically just to make sure we save the name. But one of our sky guys, Richie, actually created another one, and he is the main one. Mine's just secondary. I rarely ever post to it. So if you see one and it hardly has any posts to it, go to the other one. You'll find Richie's. He's the one that has all the posts on it, and that's really our more main.
And of course, there's the Under British Skies page, which is always well worth a look at because a lot of stories do get still posted there that are current. So have a look at that as well. Mm-hmm. And as I said earlier, do always come to the astronomy.fm website because we post all our shows there along as soon as we get the podcast, they go up there too.
Mm-hmm.
It was a comment in the thumbs up to new astronomy Facebook pages. Fair enough, Cassie.
All right. Thank you very much. Oh, we got about 6 more minutes to go. Where do we want to go?
Where should we go?
Let's go to NASA's going to launch something pretty soon. Go to the NASA. Go to the NASA page. They're going to launch a resupply. It's a SpaceX mission to resupply the International Space Station, and it's going to be tomorrow morning. Actually, I think the launch is scheduled for about 10 o'clock in the morning, Eastern North America time. So that's 15 hours universal time, I think it is, something like that. But if you go to the NASA homepage, you'll see that countdown is 12 hours to launch from right about now. So check your clock and make sure you're listening to the live version, not the repeat version, because we will repeat this program every 4 hours for the next 24 hours. So 12 hours from the live portion is when they're going to launch it. It is a Falcon 9 rocket with a Dragon capsule on it, launching from Complex 39A. They used to do a lot of launches way back when from that complex. So check it out. And watch NASA TV. You can actually watch the launch, and there'll be commentary on it too. So,
yeah, I just love the reactions sometimes to the commentators, and it's like, ooh, that looks interesting. They're in a huddle. They're all just happening. When they get into a huddle, then you know something's probably about to go wrong. But I'm looking forward to the next Falcon X from Canaveral, from the Cape Kennedy Space Center, 39A. That's going to be fun. I want to see SpaceX back in space. Mm-hmm. They are doing a very great job. And to be honest, it's a very good synergy, private and public. So you've got the private part coming from people like Blue Yonder, SpaceX, and you have the public part, which is NASA. And the fact that it's helping us to push forward is perhaps one of the greatest things going. That and the fact that even with Orion is actually becoming a multinational project, because at the moment in Germany, they're actually building the command module section to sit on the rocket and accept the Orion capsule. So this is Orion when it finally gets back on track, which I hope it has, because there have been talk, I believe, from astronaut Abby that there's going to be an unmanned launch next year. I hope it happens, because Orion really, really does need that to happen. Yes, the Falcon Heavy will definitely be a game changer, and I think it's going to be the start of Man to Mars, seriously, because we need the Falcon Heavy to do that.
Definitely. It'd be nice to go back down to Florida to watch launches again. I have never seen a launch really close to the Cape before. I saw some off small satellite launch from about 100 or 200 miles away. It looked like a little model rocket going off. People used to go to the complex within like 5-10 miles away and actually watch the space shuttle launch. They used to watch the Saturn V's launch, the Saturn 1B's launch.
Gemini and the Mercury launches.
Yeah, it was really – all the videos I saw and movies I saw, people actually watching the launches as close as you can get was actually pretty nice. So it'd be nice to get back to that again and go down there.
The interesting thing, Optronics, is the N1 rocket, which was the Russian moon rocket, if I remember correctly, is now, the engine is now being used by a lot of American companies.
Mm. Okay.
So that's great stuff. Ooh, Ceres. Let's go to Ceres. We've got a few seconds left.
Yeah, the asteroid Ceres has got some organic material discovered on it. Now, that doesn't mean there's life. It just means the right chemistry that life needs has been actually discovered on Ceres itself. So I put the article in the chat room, and that is from on NASA website again also, so you go right to NASA if you're just listening in and want to find that article. So that's interesting. A lot of discoveries. Ceres, I think, is still in the sky, if I'm not mistaken. I think it's down there around Uranus and Venus and stuff like that, but it's getting kind of low and harder to see. So the best place to see an asteroid for the northern hemisphere is actually in the constellation of Gemini. It's near the head of the twins, near Castor and Pollux, and Vesta's right in there too, pretty close. So that one's going to be a little bit easier than picking up Ceres. It's kind of hidden close to the western horizon. We're just about there.
I am watching the clock. There is a reason for that. You know what reason is, Duncan Marty? It's time to be getting everything back in our toolboxes, get samples together.
Image processing software back on the computer.
Yeah, we've got to get the various samples for the science labs together.
That's right.
We are running down into the last parts of the show, folks.
Time for us to head out of here.
So, USS Miranda, 3 to beam up. successful away mission.
Thanks, everybody, for listening in. I want to thank everybody in our chat room. Really appreciate you being here tonight. Great having you, and see you all again next week.
We hope that you've enjoyed this program from AFM Radio, the broadcast service of Astronomy.fm. This program has been released under Creative Commons license. Please contact us for details. You may find more of our AFM original programs on our website. It's really easy to find us. We are Astronomy.fm. You may also find us in the iTunes radio listings near the top of the News Talk section, and also as an iTunes podcast selection. We'd love to hear your comments. Please email us at radio@astronomy.fm. Thanks so much for being part of the voice of astronomy. Around the world and across the known universe, this is Astronomy.fm Radio.
Hi, this is Tavi Greiner, Astronomy.fm's Vice President of Communications. If you enjoy our programming, please let us know with a donation to astronomy.fm/donate. We really do rely on your support, and it's true, every little bit counts.
AFM.
There I was, doing my thing. And all of a sudden, wham, astronomy right between the eyes.